This is Wide Open, a series on how to embrace change and challenge your ways of thinking so you can level up your life, open up to new experiences, and pay it forward to those who need it. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez. My guest today is the founder and CEO of Act One Group, Ms. Janice Bryan-Howroyd. She's the first African-American woman to own and operate a billion-dollar business. This woman is incredible. We touch on everything that you can think of. It is the epitome of what the Wide Open podcast is about. We're going to talk about family. We're going to talk about raising children, talk about being married, relationship advice, talk about how she sleeps, what she eats, how she stays so fit and young. I don't even know her age. I'm not even going to tell you her age if I knew it anyway. But she looks amazing, and she's doing something right because it seems every aspect of her life, it just blossoms. And she lights up the room when she came in here. She's got some amazing style, too. So this is going to be a good one to look at because you're going to learn a lot. She's from the South, and she's got a lot of that Southern charm. And so little nuggets of Southern wisdom that she puts in throughout the whole time I sat with her. And so make sure you're listening out for those besides just listening to her incredible story. So this was a great one, and she came with it. She brought it, and she was wide open, and I'm glad and absolutely proud to be able to sit down with her and tap into what makes her so great. It's a good one. All right, I am joined now by Miss Janice Bryan-Howroyd. I am absolutely grateful to be sitting down with you. I came across your book, mm-hmm. and I think it's out right now.
Yes, it is.
We go out there and mm-hmm. get that book, Acting Up, right?
Yes.
And I'm not completely done with it, but I'm about 75 pages. I just got it a couple days ago, but it's been fascinating to learn all about you and what you've done. First of all, you look like a movie star.
Oh yeah, right.
I'm not kidding you.
Yeah,
especially okay, in this town. Right, we're in right. LA. And
knocking on 70, baby.
Knocking on 70. Oh yeah. My God, the people out there that you guys can definitely go to YouTube and check this out if you're listening to this on audio, because this woman, you look fabulous.
Oh, well, I was telling you.
My wife when I went out, and I said, she's here.
Your wife is lovely.
Oh, she's great. She's great. Mm-hmm. But I was like, man, she looks so young. She looks so great. She looks like a movie star. So I appreciate you doing something.
It's my heart showing through.
And we'll get to that because I got to hear about your workout routine, how you take care of yourself, how you stay so fit and so young. But before we get into that, I want to talk about, I want to get to the good stuff, but can you give us just I know it's in your book, but just give us a brief understanding. We were just talking about Tarboro, North Carolina, which is where you're from. How you grew up, that back in the day, what was it like growing up in the South, right? That's considered the South?
Yeah, it is. It's very much the South. Tony is Southeast, so it's one of the poorest parts of the nation. And I will tell you that it's quite a paradox to describe how I grew up. Because I grew up one of 11 children, one mom, one dad, in a very spiritual-based home and a religious home. They are different. And I didn't really understand that we were poor growing up because we had more than other people in our community. Mm-hmm. And we knew all of our neighbors, so there was a share. Later in life, I remember laughing with joy when Hillary Clinton talked about it taking a village to raise a child. And we all know that's African proverb, but in my community, that was very much African American lifestyle. Our village knew us. People, Miss Mary down the road could spank you if you were misbehaving because she knew John and Elretha would do the same. Uh-huh. And so that's kind of the, I would say it's the black version of a Norman Rockwell type setting. It's idyllic in many ways, but underneath it are very deep stories of people's histories and we are a direct slave community. So a lot of that was a part of how I grew up as well. We were a segregated community. In Tarboro at that time, Tony, I remember, and you know, this isn't gospel, but I do remember it being very black and white, and Panola Street divided black from white. And we had two Jewish families. And back then, we in our community didn't look at Jewish as white. We looked at Jewish as Jewish. Mm-hmm. And because of the hard rules around religion in the Deep South as well. So we were happy children. We were resourceful. Most of the people in my community were from families with moms and dads. And so in a lot of ways, it prepared me for the world. And in a lot of ways, I got shocked when I left the nest.
Mm-hmm. And so,
does that help you to understand Tavara?
Absolutely, yeah. And so you just said you got shocked when you left the nest. Did that start, because in your book, I did read up to that point where you went to, you desegregated. You're one of the first people in your community to desegregate the local segregated high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And my story, I'm of mixed race, right. And I'm from Huntington Beach, California,
yeah.
But it's pretty much all white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And being a person of ethnicity growing up in the 80s, when a lot of that stuff was very still prevalent in California, at least, and now it's still prevalent across the
country. And my kids are mixed, and they grew up in Rolling Hills.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So I got called the N-word, mm-hmm. I got called the S-word, the spick word, I got called a lot of different things, and it was hard to deal with that. How did you deal with that when you said you got shocked and you went to that high school? What was that like, making that transition?
Well, I remember sitting in my English, it's funny that I'm going to share this of all things. I remember sitting in my English class and listening to the English teacher talk. Tarboro was a population then of less than 12,000 people, as it is now. And I remember thinking English was a strong suit for me, and I'm not going to make it out of here. I couldn't understand what she was saying. Her Southern drawl was so deep. And now I come from a family. We are Southern drawl people, okay? Mm-hmm. And when we're really having fun, we are ebonically Southern drawl. But I couldn't understand what she was saying, and I thought, I'm not going to make it out. So there was a language barrier even from East Panola to west of Panola for me, mm-hmm. in that small town. The other thing that was very shocking for me is that it was the first time I was being called, as you talked about, nigger to my face, or being seen as less than. Remember now, on my side of the community, we were a pretty important family in my community, and attending the all black school there was ages in that, being a Bryant. Now I'm a Bryant across the street, across Panola Street, and all of a sudden this nigger go home.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're going through that, what do you tell yourself?
Like, well, I was in a history class, and the teacher stood up on the desk and he explained in some very literal terms why blacks were very well suited for slavery. This is U.S. history taught in the late 60s or in North Carolina. And he was explaining specifically why black men, he didn't refer to them as black, were so well suited for slavery, and talked about the build and all brawn, no brain. And I remember sitting there, and I've got five brothers. I remember sitting in that class in 11th grade, and to this day, if I open up my mouth, you can see where I retain. I bit so hard, I was bleeding down my throat. And I just said, please don't let me cry. Let me get home without shedding a tear. When I got home, I told my dad I wasn't going back to school. Dad offered me three options. The option I took naturally meant I was going back to the school. And he had basically said, look, you got a better shot at a scholarship there. You're all going to go to college. And at that time, there were now 10 of us left in the home. He said, if we have to sell this land, you're going to college, but it'll be a really good help if you can go get that scholarship. So I went back to the school. My brothers would escort me to school in the mornings, and Then different brothers would escort me home in the evenings. By the way, we still follow that protocol in my business. I never go anywhere on my own without a sibling with me as I travel, that we work together. And I think that because we were rooted so deeply as a family, we didn't see it as my education. We saw it as my part of the family education, and that was the role I would take, that I don't know that I had to find necessarily my strength as I made it through on the our strength. Mm-hmm. I mean, you come from a sport and a team environment. I think you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You can, there is a natural strength and a skill you have to have to be a part of a team and play your role well. Mm-hmm. And our family operated that way. And that was my role. Go over there and you make sure that they know that the world doesn't decline when Black folks show up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an old saying in football, do your job.
Yeah.
And it's we.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Not
yeah.
I. And all of us, that's how you, that's built.
Even in my company
teams.
Today, you can't go into any branch or listen to any type of education process for more than 2 minutes without hearing together we win.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just thematically how I've built a business well.
That's how it's done. But there was a great quote I read in the book from your father. He told you, he said, only you can determine how you feel about you.
Right.
And that hit me. That hit me right here. And I was like, that is such good advice. And you learned that at a very young age.
Yeah.
Your father
and I had to relearn it. I'm sure you've had things in your life you've had to relearn it as well. Let me tell you something. When I hit LA and I'm this little dark-skinned, nappy-headed, colored girl coming into LA where every Black person I saw was gorgeous like you, right? And my sister, Sandy, one mom, one dad, I told you, okay? And our family's all mixed up too. But I got the side from my mom and I grew up really feeling bad about that. I was a girl who couldn't go swimming if we had an event that evening because it'd take too much time to do my hair. Uh-huh. My sisters could go swimming and float, right? In any event, I hit LA and I came on a vacation. And my sister was very, very light skinned, very, 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 just gorgeous. There's no other way to put it. And most folks thought she was white. And we're over at her pool in Ladera. All these girls show up and, you know, they got purses with other people's initials on them and they look fabulous and nobody's wearing stockings or anything. And I'm supposed to be coming to for a party as well. And I got on pantyhose and, you know, my purse ain't got no initials on it. And I'm just feeling like, wow, you know, I'm out of. And so I started to let that impact me a lot in LA. And my sister pulled me aside and she was so awesome. And she told me, this space between your ears is the most expensive real estate you'll ever own. Don't let people live there rent free. And that sustained me through business. So Sandy iteratively was teaching me what Dad had taught me all those years ago. But when you live in a world that really is changing so much, I had a 6 foot two redheaded fellow come work in our company for a year from a business school in England. And I was talking with him just before he departed a few weeks ago about his experience and what he planned. And he said, it's so awful. And I asked him, why? Why is it so awful? He said, well, I'll tell you, Mrs. Halroyd, I've learned so much here. This has been a wonderful experience. I don't know how long it's going to matter. This is a white male living in a changing world, right? Yeah. 6 foot two and redhead. Okay, now we know a lot of that emotionally speaks to how predictably successful he will be, right?
Yeah.
And he said to me, I don't know where the world's going to be. Do you understand that that the European map has changed more in my lifetime than it did for hundreds of years before I was born? Do you understand that I started school and I had ideas about where I'd work in Europe. And now that's different for me, talking about Brexit. And I asked him, I said, well, where are you coming from? Why are you feeling this sense of doom? He goes to restaurants that say proudly our meat isn't, you know, produced in America. And he's concerned about the environment. He's concerned about the condition of the world. All of these things are happening for him at rapid pace as well. And I reflected for him that in my own life, things have happened at rapid pace for me. And I wrapped it under the civil rights because we have the luxury, quote unquote, in the U.S. of being able to designate things as racial as from post-slavery. But you've got the same conditions for life that everybody cares about, whether you're African-American, whether you're female, whether you're millennial. I had a young millennial tell me 4 years ago, oh, being a millennial is like being the new Black. And I asked her, well, how is that? Oh, come on, JBH. My girls call me JBH. Oh, come on, JBH. You know, we are who you're talking about when you're standing around in the office now, you know? And so everybody's got their own stuff.
Yeah.
and we've got more access to that stuff, and we're being infused with it. We don't always choose it. Sometimes it comes at us. Doesn't stuff pop up on your phone?
All the time.
You stop and take a look. Yeah. Some of it's like stopping on a freeway at a train wreck. Well, that's what's happening emotionally for so many of these young people. And that's what was happening for me. And so, Tony, I guess if we're wrapping this back around about life lessons, I don't sit and in some celebratory fashion say, wow, I made it through. You know, we used to sing a song in church, how I got over. Sometimes my soul looks back to wonder how I got over. No, 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 no. Everybody today is carrying a cross. Mm-hmm. Everybody's bearing one. And we're so collectively aware of what's going on in the world that our decision process, if it's not clean, if it's not coming from a really secure place, as for many children, it is not today, then we get kind of stuck in traffic, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting, like you said, we all have our unique stories. And everybody's story is different and special and unique to them. But the underlying fear, the anxiety, the stress, it's all there. I mean, everybody goes through it. Nobody's immune to it. So when you're talking to those young millennials, what advice do you give them to get around that? How do they combat those feelings of separatism? Because like in Brexit, like now, well, we don't buy from America, or hey, we're black owned, or we're white owned, or whatever it is. We don't have from China. Like, how do you, with all this separatism that's being preached out there, what do you do to get around that and still feel good about yourself?
On the collective measure, and I do want to say, yesterday, I was at, it was the day before yesterday, I was at Morehouse, and I was in an auditorium filled with millennials and instructors, and that question came up as well. And I thought about it for a moment, kind of put myself on pause, because, you know, when you're talking about, what do you tell millennials? And that's my crew, although I'm rapidly thinking about becoming a next gen because millennials are getting a bit old for me. You don't throw a one-size-fits-all solution when people are asking you a question from that place. That's a desperate question. What I will say, though, is that I encourage every time that these young folk become students of history. We've been people a long time on earth. The Romans went through what we're going through. You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So if you're a true student of history, then you can get some understanding of, and by the way, there is a saying that it used to be engraved, I think, over the door on Helms Bakery over off of Venice Boulevard here in Southern California. I think it's Culver City. Those who forget their history are doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. I think we can paraphrase and say those who know their history are able to predict their future, you know, and you can learn so much. So I do tell them to look at that, you know. Mm-hmm. What we're going through is not new. It's new for us. Now, what is very different and new, we talk about Ice Age, right? Well, now we're talking about the environment. So if we can kind of get outside of our boxes and look at history, then I think we're in a better position, whether we look at history from its politics, its ecology, its agri changes, however we choose to look at history, we can learn a lot about who we are, where we're placed, and how we can go forward. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. When you talk about navigating today's terrain, whether it's race, whether it is sexism, wherever we're looking at it, I do think that it becomes more specific and you have to hear the individual. And the answer I gave at Morehouse was, I'm not talking with people from where I am. I'm talking with them from where they're coming. Mm-hmm. So I have to understand who they are. To share my experience can be interesting to them. To know their experience and talk with them from that can be guiding. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
Yeah, that does help. You're like a great coach. That talks about everybody is in it together. And in your book, you talked about, I guess before I tell you what really touched me in your book, yesterday or 2 days ago, I took, my son broke his arm in two places, a couple of days. He was on those Heelys going down the, you know, acting like a fool. I was like, come on. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he broke his arm. we get to the emergency room and I'm filling out the questionnaire. And of course that question comes up, what race is he? Mm-hmm. And I was reading in your book.
I was reading in your book.
With your children. You guys did home birth, right? The way mm-hmm. I understood
yeah,
it. And
yeah,
then
we did. My husband thought he married an Amazon.
And on the birth certificate, instead of writing a race, you wrote human.
Yeah. We didn't write black or white. We wrote human.
Uh-huh. And I wrote that on his question.
You did. That's so good. I'm so glad.
And especially me, I'm multiracial. Yeah. You know, I got Latino, I got African American, I got white, I got it all. And then what is your reason that you would just write human as a race?
When Bernie and I were giving birth, we were very invested in what the world. Now, I'm not a Pollyanna. Mm-hmm. However, I do not lose idealism, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think that some of the best things that have happened for us on planet Earth as human is from the idealists, you know? And so when we were giving birth, we were highly cognizant that the world was, we didn't quite know just how cray-cray it could get. But we were highly cognizant that the world was in a rapid change mode. History's happening a lot quicker today. And I even debated having children. I didn't know if I wanted to contribute life to where I felt a little out of water. Mm-hmm. And my husband talked with me and explained to me why it was a good idea. And so by the time we had Kay and I looked at her and we're filling out these forms, and they're asking me what race she is, I wanted her to have the gift of knowing that she can be a part of a human race and it's up to her whether she chooses to segregate herself. Now, I do see great value in understanding ethnically who our population is from a health perspective. There are just some things that it is handy to know. For instance, I'd love more funding for sickle cell. Mm-hmm. And that tends to run in the black race. Mm-hmm. But my sister, Trish, came to California as an adult with a master's degree in engineering and nearly died because in North Carolina, the physician she was seeing misdiagnosed her. I took her to a doctor out here. He diagnosed her with Crohn's. And she said, oh, I thought I had Crohn's as well when I did my research. He said, well, wait, what are you talking about? And she said the physician she was seeing in North Carolina told her she couldn't have Crohn's because she wasn't Jewish. He took a very black and white approach mm-hmm. to her illness, literally and figuratively, that nearly killed her. She's thriving, alive, well, and, you know, dropping it like it's hot today. But her life was at risk because of somebody's narrow perspective by looking at the color of her skin, determining what her inside was made of. Mm. And Dr. King warned us against that. But here's a man practicing medicine under they take the Hippocratic Oath, and he's going to diagnose her based on the color of her skin and not the content of her body.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go back to you starting your company.
Yeah.
Obviously. Mm-hmm. You now are owner and operator of a billion-dollar company. Mm-hmm. A lot of people see that. And they say, wow, that's amazing, which it is. It is really amazing. But what are you most proud of building that company? Like, what do you look back and say, you know what, the people, like in football, for instance, for me, like people can they'll see all the records and they'll see me, okay, you did this, you scored all these touchdowns, you made all these records, but that's not what I'm most proud of.
Wait a minute, let me get my crowd roar. Whoa!
But that's not what I'm most proud of. Don't get me wrong, I'm proud of that, but I want people, what was the underlining you that made that happen? Because people can get caught up in seeing the success, but I want people to understand what went into it and what you're most proud of.
That's an awesome, you know, people say, good question. All questions are good, okay? Only the ones not asked aren't. That's truly an awesome question, Tony, because what you did was you asked me, what am I most proud of and what made me want to build a company. Mm-hmm. And to tie that together is really a big part of my story. I started my company because I wasn't finding work the way I wanted work to, and I wasn't being treated the way I wanted in that experience. Simply put, what I'm proudest of, let me share with you, because they each have equity in what I'm proud of. One, the first thing that comes to mind for me is that my kids see this as something they want to do. My husband and I never talk to our kids about the family business or coming in. And I say family business because my mom and dad birthed my best friends in life, and they birthed some of the greatest talent in my organization. I'm sitting here talking with you today because of the gift of love that a brother and a sister-in-law are showing me, taking care of my husband, who is in his sixth phase of Alzheimer's right now. And that is, these days I find myself always one smile away from a tear. It's new for us, and we're figuring it out as a family. And we're making bold choices that we're told could be much more simplified. But anyway, to answer your question dynamically, I'm really proud that our children see what we do and they get under it. They know it and they love it. And our son now, Brett, is leading Apple One, our staffing brand. Kay is phenomenal to the technology build out and the branding of our organization, so that they want to do that, never having been encouraged to do so. It's just brilliant for me. The other thing that is really strong for me is that we truly built a company based on how we want to see the world. And so people win and fail in our organization based on their effort, but not on protocol. That the applicant is the center of the universe has been core to who we are for 50 years. And now we find large international publicly funded companies putting so much money and math behind trying to promote that as an idea. And it's been what the core of who we are for so long. That's a huge compliment. And even as a Christian, I got to stop and say, hey, well done.
Good job. Yeah.
Let me just say one more thing.
Sure, please.
That we truly are escorting people into great careers, and that just a few months ago, I started All STEM, which is all STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math jobs, and bringing women heavily into the fold of technical work. I'm real proud of that because it's taken me all my career to build the revenue stream to support to do it the way I want to. And a young man who led Agile One for me, Peter Carvalho, for years, we sat and we talked about it and we had several discussions over it. And I really wanted Peter to understand why this is so important to me. And so collectively, we're out there and we're placing women and minorities in jobs that they just don't get the opportunity to. And that is really something I'm proud of as well.
Oh, that's outstanding. I love just listening because I'm getting a good glimpse on how you think. What influenced that, though? I know it was your reading your book. I know you had entrepreneurs all around you. The family is an entrepreneurial act in itself, running a good family. But I'm a big reader. I love reading books. It kind of changed my life.
Yeah, I actually read the stuff on my shelves.
All these books I've read.
So here's how I do it, though. Several years ago, we were going off to a celebration. May I?
Sure.
Several years ago, we were going off to a celebration. Each year, we take our top performers out for a 4 or 5 day founders club is what we call it. And we take them to different locations. So my sister Trish and I are on the plane, and I've got all these books, you know, in my backpack, on my back, right? And I'm feeling pretty good because, you know, I'm sporting my little Chanel backpack and being all cute. And my sister gets on and she's got one little purse. And I'm like, where are your books, Trish? Where are your books? Oh, I got them here. And she pulls out this Kindle and she shows me that she's got over 200 books in a Kindle, right? So here's my thing now. I do have Kindle downloaded on my iPad and I continue to read voraciously. However, if I love a book that I read online, I go back and in homage to that author, I will buy that hardback and put it on my shelf. Uh-huh. There's something that just doesn't get better than candles, yellow roses, a onesie, and a good book. Just turning pages. And I write in mine. You know,
me too.
I don't care if they're leather or whatever. I'm writing in them. You know, I'm putting my thoughts in them. So
what is your 3 recommended books? I know As a Man Thinketh,
Yes.
Was one
which
of them.
Which I redid into As a Person Thinketh with permission.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Because, you know, got to get one for the ladies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And any other books out there that you recommend to young people?
Yeah, Art of War.
Art of War.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very, very important. I mean, you ask, so the Bible is always good,
sure,
whether you're
sure.
reading it as history, whether you're reading it as psychology, or whether you're reading it as a Christian and really into, you know, my mom says, you know, if you're going to argue creation and evolution, you're stupid because they're not offenders of each other.
So,
but then, you know, and my book, naturally, I want to read mine, right?
Great book. So, mm-hmm. so I'm looking for the influences of what it is to be you. Mm-hmm. Anything that you're reading right now?
Mm-hmm.
You got any?
Yeah. I'm rereading a book and it's called From Good to Great.
Uh-huh.
I'm rereading that. Years ago, a client recommended it to me. And when he first recommended it to me, I was like, okay, we're coming up on contract season. What's happening here? And I read it and it was really impactful to me. And now as I look at where we are as a business and where I am as a person placed in life, I'm taking it out of the business context and applying it to myself. So I'm doing some reread on that.
I love that.
I love all the black authors. So when I want novels or fun stuff, I read that as well.
So you read everything. You'll read novels, fiction, whatever it is.
I'm a snob about chocolate. It's got to be dark chocolate, right? But I'm not a snob about books. I read everything. I think everybody's got something to say. And Dad used to tell us, you can learn from anybody. You don't look down, because there was a man in our community. I won't call his name because folks in North Carolina are going to be listening too, right?
Mm-hmm.
We as kids used to laugh at him because he used to walk around talking to himself. And Dad told us, don't laugh at him. You can learn from anybody. Mm. You can learn from anybody. And so I thought, I'm going to prove my dad wrong and I'm actually going to go listen. That man was saying some real serious stuff. And by the way, there are a lot of those people walking around LA today and other cities, and we're not listening to them because they're living on the street. But they're saying some pretty serious stuff.
Great advice. That's great advice. That's something I've been working on.
Yeah.
You know, because when you're young and you think you know it all and you're like, I've had some success, but really you can learn from anybody, mm-hmm. even your own children. Just listen to them. That's what I tell a lot of young parents. And let's go into—
And listening to people. My mother-in-law gave me great advice. I asked her when early I visited her before Bernie and I actually— we're going to have kids. And I asked her, if we do have kids, you know, what is your best advice in raising kids? And she said, well, I'm not going to do the British accent. I'm just too Southern for that. Although there are places in North Carolina where the Shakespearean actress come to study the language because it's so uninterrupted that it sounds closer to what Shakespeare's actual period talk was than they can find in England. But what she did tell me stuck with me. She said, your children more attention pay to what you do than what you say.
Mm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And you've heard, maybe you've said it yourself. I say it goes in one ear and out the other. They never forget what they saw you do.
Yeah.
Or how you acted. You know?
Great advice. And so how does that go with your objectives, right? Is that mm-hmm. is that what I, how you raise children, your philosophy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is that all about?
Be transparent, be honest. Not be afraid to let them know who's boss in the relationship until they've earned the right to be a peer. In my family, you don't get to peer mom. When I go to visit mom, I know mom locks the door at 11, then I'm going to be respectful of that. I'm going to be inside or I'm going to make arrangements. And I think you can have a lot of fun and a lot of freedom with your children when your children understand that there is that level of security around them. And that security evolves for kids. It's explained to kids as this is how we live. You know, people, oh, I want to live in a no rule society. No, you don't. No, you don't. The universe has rules. And so you learn to follow those. Some of the best following of universal rules I saw was with the the original people in Australia. I went there to do sessions with some business leaders, right? And I went out and I visited the area with all of the, you know. And,
Aborigines?
Yeah. And then I visited all the areas with the, needles and stuff in the ground and looked at what had happened to the people who had integrated away from following the universe role. Uh-huh. Then I went and I visited some who were still following the universe, the people who follow the animals up the hill when the monsoons come. And I saw 90, at least they were represented to me as being 90-year-old men, and they're out there spearfishing, you know. Mm-hmm. So there is a freedom and there is a continuity that can be brilliant and beautiful when we do follow rules and when we know what the rules are. And Jesse Jackson talked a little, wherever you are with Reverend, he talked a lot about in ways that can educate us. He talked about rules as well, right? And he talked about when we let Black folks play the game. They enhance the game and they elevate and they can help change the rules that are better for everybody. So, yeah, I'm about kids understanding that, you know. Our kids felt security in our rules. They also felt freedom in them, which is why our daughter at 16 could jump in a van with her best friend who became like my daughter and drive across country. And people were like, oh, I can't believe it. You're going to let her drive across country at 16. Your family, you know. She knows the rules. She can take care of herself.
I love what you just said. Security in the rules, but freedom within the rules.
Yes.
That's good parenting advice.
Yes, absolutely.
Right there.
Our government has rules that allow us our best freedoms. Freedom isn't free. Mm-hmm. Freedom is earned.
Tell me, so let's, you've been married 30 years now to Bernie?
Near 40.
Near 40 years.
Yeah.
Okay, I've been married 12 years.
Yes.
Been together 15 years.
Yeah.
And marriage out there for all our listeners, they know it is tough. How do you make the how do you keep that alive? Because you speak of Bernie, I can see the twinkle in your eye.
Married my hero.
And in your book, it's a Bernie's advice is all the way throughout that. And wow, you hit
funny
the jackpot.
Thing,
it seems
funny
like.
Thing. Mm-hmm. When I completed that book, we weren't in this new scary place called Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of glad I decided to throw the... Don't ask me too much right now, Tony, because I'm still very new.
Okay,
it's very infant for me.
Sure.
And
I didn't even know about the Alzheimer's. So I didn't mean to go there. I'm just, what about relationships?
And we're not ashamed of it. I mean, you know, the disease deserves to be talked about. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life because this incredible, beautiful human being, we didn't plan this for us right now. He is, one thing I've learned, even in this horrible place of disconnect for him, he didn't get dumb with Alzheimer's. He's still a brilliant person. He's a brilliant person who has disconnections and it's new. It's difficult to talk about.
I know
right
it is.
Now.
And I'm tearing up because, you know, I played football those years and something that happens with us is CTE.
Yes.
And I have some friends that I've played with that are experiencing this now as I've gotten older. So that hits home
life
with me.
Life interrupted is a very difficult thing. I think that he is truly proving and, you know, our children and my family are so brilliant and my family are all sports fans, so I know they're listening. So I really have to just shout out kudos to everybody my mom and dad gave birth to because I've said for years, Mom, you gave birth to some of my best friends. I'm in a very new and difficult place, as is the family, but I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Community.
I'm not alone in it. The family is so strong. And the family aren't just the people who mom and dad gave birth to. And this is why it's so important to make really good decisions about your careers and place yourself in cultures you enjoy, not just jobs you enjoy. I can't tell you how beautiful the Apple One, the Agile One, the Act One family are. A-Check, all of these people, they know and they love Bernie and they are as harmed and they are as loving as, you know, we are around where he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
Really good people.
If you could give me just, what is your number one advice you can give all our married people out there for to have a productive relationship?
Be honest about it really quickly. Mm-hmm. Be honest about it really quickly. It is whatever it is. You know, in those early days, you overlook a lot of stuff because the other stuff is so good, you know, or you don't want to mess it up or whatever. And so you hold it back. But when I went up, Bernie and I for years lived right on Venice Beach, where our son lives now, in a 3-story house. They actually filmed a jazz singer there with Neil Diamond. Mm-hmm. My mom came out and she saw me running up and down 3 stories taking tea to Bernie. And she said, "Are you going to do that forever?" I said, "Well, I just," she said, "start out how you can end out."
Oh, wow.
You know, if you don't give him tea today and you give him some a month later, it's going to be a treat. If you give it to him that first week and you don't a month later, you're starting to slip.
Uh-huh. You know? Okay, so set the precedent right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
I truly think, Tony, that what makes my marriage to Bernie all these years later still, I mean, even now when he does have those moments of connection, it's beautiful. And what makes it such a romantic, I feel so loved by him, mm-hmm. you know, it's the honesty. Mm-hmm. Being truly honest with each other mm-hmm. about everything. You're not going to always agree, but you can always be honest. Mm. And we talked earlier about the rules and the security for children in love, whether it's romantic or of whatever nature it is. The honesty is what creates the threat of security. Mm. I know I'm wrong doing this, even if it's premeditated. And I also know I can be honest mm-hmm. about it.
And within that honesty, because I say this to my wife all the time, you don't have to be brutally honest.
Right.
You can be lovingly honest.
Yes.
A lot of people mistake that sometimes. They think, well, me being honest is telling them exactly what's on my mind. It's like, no, you got to filter that through your heart, that honesty.
Yeah, because truth and honesty are near same, but not same. Uh-huh. What people are practicing is truth when they're being mean. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes using something that is an absolute to rub. Honesty is whole. Honesty is a combination of truths, and it's the collective of all of them. Are you hearing what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I can truthfully sit here and I can say, maroon is not my favorite color shirt. But honesty demands that I say, wow, it's really beautiful when your golden, well-formed body wears it. Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's honesty. Yeah. And a lot of people stop short with a few truths and they interrupt people's lives in a miserable way, namely their own.
Yeah. Yeah. Wisdom. I love it. All right. Let's, it's wide open. So I told you at the top of the show how great you look. What is your secret to keeping it great, beautiful?
What is it they say? You don't live to eat, you eat to live.
Uh-huh. Is that you?
I'm a Southerner, and so for a lot of years that wasn't true. It's become more and more true for me now. The things that I enjoy, I can enjoy in minute portion if they don't fit within how I want to feel good. My son is very dedicated to his health, and and our daughter, my husband would say, it's my son too, and our daughter. Kay is always sending me tips and ideas and lately videos of her creating beautiful meals out of very good food. And she's the one who taught me that a lot of what I've been eating for years isn't food. Mm-hmm. And so how I approach food is very different now. And I find that I'm actually reverting to the way mom fed us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's those years in the middle that kind of cheated me of the health that I want. I also don't like makeup, so I have to stay healthy in order to, you know, uh-huh. which now you can see with these tears,
no,
right? I'd be a wreck, right? I think that exercising is important. So a lot of times I'm in a hotel, I don't carry a lot of stuff with me. Mm-hmm. If it's under 3 days, I can do it with a carry-on. That's my rule. And so that means I'm improvising. So I'm using the bottoms of beds to, you know, anchor my feet to, you know, and those kinds of things.
So you're going
to
work out in the room, in the hotel room.
I love working out.
Push-ups, yeah. Sit-ups, yeah. Stretching, mm-hmm. All that stuff.
Yeah.
Do you have any other at your house? Do you use?
We have a gym.
Use a sauna?
I have a sauna. I don't use it. It hasn't been operable for a while, but I don't use any heat nor air conditioning. Thank you, Southern California. Uh-huh. I don't use that in my home. My husband, when you pull up to our house, we have kumquats and oranges and all kinds of food citrus around the house. Where you pull up to other people's homes, like your beautiful home here in this lovely landscape. My husband grows food all around the house. Uh-huh. So, you know, we do literally squeeze our own.
So fresh fruits, organic, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm, and so that's your nutrition, your diet. Do you eat red meat a lot? I know you grew up with the barbecue pit, right?
Right. And I love the pork. But here's the thing. I can't say this because I don't want to hurt people's feelings, but I buy it and feed other people. So let me preamble. Okay. But I never like beef myself. So I don't eat that, but everything else I eat and I prepare and I serve beef in my home. I just am not. And it's just how I cook. That's different. You know, I'd rather grill it if I can. And you know, the only exception to that rule is that because I did grow up frying chicken, people still make me do that a lot for them, but I don't eat it when I do it. I feed it to them because they ask.
And I got a feeling you can throw down in the kitchen. So speaking of that though,
Sunday dinners are at my house.
Sunday dinners. I grew up with Sunday dinners, which believe it in California, that's not a very common thing at all. Maybe down in the South it is. Mm-hmm. But I loved it. This is like my childhood memories was my father barbecuing, my stepdad, Michael, barbecuing all the meat. I invite my friends over from high school. My cousins would be there and my aunts, my uncles, and we would just sit around and eat every Sunday and just enjoy each other's company. Mm-hmm. And so good for the family. This is something that you did growing up and you still do this to this day. You do
every
this, right?
day that I'm home. Uh-huh. I've got girlfriends who are like, you gotta be kidding. You got 3-4 people working around in your house and you're still cooking. And I'm like, but that allows me to do what I want to do. And my kids have pegged me. They say that it takes me less than 3 minutes from the door to be in my onesie and in my kitchen.
Cooking. You love to cook.
Yeah, I'm not a great cook. Uh-huh. I am an ambitious cook. Uh-huh. I love it.
I think passionate that's great. What do those Sunday dinners mean to you?
Everything happens at Sunday dinners. Children have equal rights in their voice, and we don't hide subject matter from our kids. I'm not recommending that for anybody, so I hope nobody's offended. But we talk about it all with our kids, not around them, with them. You may get some Al Green, or you may get some Common pumped up in the middle of dinner, and folks get up and dance. My table, we usually have about 18 to 22 people around the table on Sunday. We always start dinner with prayer. We move it around. We try to keep it off of my brother Carlton because he prays for sex as well out loud.
Yeah.
His wife is sitting there right by him and he's like, and please let her do the doom, 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 you know? And we're like, no, this ain't that prayer, right? Oh, wow. You know? But it's busy. We talk about politics. We talk about all the things that you're not supposed to talk about. At our Sunday dinners. This is where we heal ourselves. This is our community. We all come and we, you know.
That sounds great to me. That sounds like my family. Honestly. Yeah. Nothing was off limits. And
we're loud.
Loud, dancing, music, all that stuff.
Yeah. It can take 4 hours because, you know, you got to get up and get your groove on in the middle. And we do the soul train around the table.
Yeah. Highly, highly recommend to everybody out there with your family, start this type of tradition, a Sunday dinner, because it is one of the most memorable experiences of me growing up and as a father now with my kids. I got four kids and they bring friends over and we do it all the time. People bring their kids over, we get in the pool, we do all that stuff. It's such a good time.
And it's beautiful that it's DNA related. There are family members who are not DNA related as well who mm-hmm. can, you know.
Yeah. I got three adopted
brothers. You're part of that, right.
I know all about that. A couple final questions. Sleep. Oh, before we get that, because you wanted some tea before we went on. And I said, do you want some sugar? And they're like, no sugar. Do you eat sugar at all? Or is that something you eliminate from your diet?
I eat natural sugars. I eat honey. Mm-hmm. I like stuff sweet, but it's just not me.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I get it. It works.
I'm sweet enough.
And sleeping. Mm-hmm. What are your sleep habits like?
I am horrible example for people because all of my life I have thought of sleep as death. And so sleep is like little deaths. And I know you need to sleep to regenerate and heal. But for me, typically, if I'm sleeping 4 hours, I'm really well rested. And anything over, I feel drugged. So that's just my own body.
My
team members, my employees, they don't even laugh anymore because I tell people, look, if I text you, wait to don't take the ding off of me. Respond when you want, because I will text and email any hour. I work in different time zones though. Uh-huh. So if I'm going to give myself, we taught our kids that there's a difference between excuses and reasons. Not sure if this is an excuse or if it's a reason, but I do work in different time zones. And so, you know, finding that 9 till 7 sleep zone just isn't going to be practical anymore. Anyway.
Uh-huh. 4 hours of sleep. Wow. Wow.
That's a lot for me.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to tell you. I've read this whole book on sleep. I'm not even going to tell you what they told me about 4 hours of sleep.
I know people tell you it's so valuable. Yeah. My sister-in-law, Ruby, not only did she feed my family while I was on the road this time, she also introduced me, that's Carlton's wife, she introduced me to something called the Beamer. You're an athlete. Do you use the Beamer?
No.
They use it in some of the in some of the rooms for athletes now. It's, uh-huh. it's common. But it's this mattress thing. I'm not even going to try to suggest how it works. But it's Beamer. I'm not an agent. I don't own stock. Uh-huh. But it's just been incredible for me.
Okay.
She introduced me to that. And the reason I bring it up is because if I do find myself feeling a bit tired during the middle of the day and I go on that for 8 minutes, it's almost as though I got those 4 hours of sleep again.
Okay, so you're somewhat of a biohacker.
Yeah,
and we love that. I love
hearing
about that.
Dr. John Kim, mm-hmm. he's right down on Redondo Beach, block from the beach. Actually, years ago, I had an accident, and it disfigured my face. I looked really like I was scaring small kids, right? And I was told that if I had surgery, there was a 50-50 chance that I could be better or worse. That's not a good odds. But I was in pain all the time, and I love to laugh, and it hurt to laugh. Oh. And Kay said, Mom, we got to fix you. At least we can get some of the pain out. And so she took me to see Dr. John Kim, and he did acupuncture on my face, and within 20 minutes, the pain had gone.
Really?
And this little nerve right down here, like if you look closely, sometimes you don't have to get that close. And, you know, it kind of dies out a little bit right there. He did remarkable work. My face, I had gone on, Erin Burnett was then still on MSNBC, and she had asked me to come on in, for her in London as a guest expert. And I was saying, I can't, I'm wrecked. I look horrible because, you know, I was doing conversations about work in the morning at that time. And I went into the studio. She said the guy would be kind. And it's out there on the internet. You probably can find it. I don't take stuff down or hide stuff. But I looked so horrible. And I was like, wow. My son has said, if people are paying more attention to how you look than what you're saying, you're not saying anything. Mm-hmm. And so go do the thing. Don't fail. But John Kim worked with me, and he helped me so much. And even now, sometimes from different angles, people will see me on my socials, and I'll get like haters who will say, oh, that surgery, or what are you doing, or whatever. Little do they know, I was wrecked, but acupuncture helped get me back a little bit. So I learned to believe in it for how I help the whole health as well. And it's really important to me. At least once a month. Back then, I was trying to get in every week, though.
I love it. That's my thing is biohacking. I have a similar to the Beamer mat. I have a bio mat or whatever, and it's like amethyst crystals.
They
and
may
it heats
be the
up.
Same thing.
And yeah. one of it is the same thing, but they have things called Juve, which is good for your skin. It's like red light therapy, infrared sauna, all that stuff. I eat for skin.
I truly live in the fruit category. You asked about sweets. I live a lot in the fruit category. I truly eat for skin. Even to heal. I wore like a, what do you call it? Costume bracelet. And I got this thing on my wrist. And my girlfriend told me to wrap banana peel around it. And look, it's healing up. It was all over here.
Banana peel, okay.
I put the gloves on, put the banana peel at night. And in the morning. And I've only done it like four times and it's already healing beautifully. Yeah.
I'm big into that.
I mean,
herbs.
I don't think God was a fool. God knew we would be stupid, clumsy human. So God gave us a lot of stuff to help us in that journey.
Absolutely. By the way, with sleep though, you could be, and I think you are because it's worked so long for you and you look great. But in this great book by Matthew Walker, PhD, called Why We Sleep. And I had a chance to actually sit down and talk to him. And he said the people, if you rounded it to the nearest number, the people that can survive on 4 hours of sleep is 0%. He goes, it's 0.3% of the population, but there are a certain sect of the population that can do it. He's all more like it's not you, but I've talked to one other person who's looks just like you. He's a man though, but he's young. He's a little bit older, but he's young, looks young, great skin. He's run a $1 billion company. And I think he's one of those other people too. So I'm very fortunate. I think I've met two
I think
of
it's
these
cooperative though, Tony, because it's not just about sleeping 4 hours. It's about what you're doing when you're awake as well. You know, they all have to play together. You can sleep for 8 hours and still wreck yourself by not living well while you're awake. So I think it's a combination of those things. As a child, I used to read up under the covers with the flashlight at night while my sisters laying next to me were asleep. Cause you know, we're a big family, you know, we didn't have 11 beds. But I would be reading. And so I think there's value to rest. And I think sleep is a really good quality of rest. I think you can rest absent sleep as well.
Do you any type of meditation or?
Yeah. And that's where I'm going. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You, so you do meditation?
Yes, I do.
Oh, nice. How long have you done that?
Oh geez, too long to even count.
Really?
Yeah, remember now, I lived on the beach for years, so how are you gonna live there and not, you know, appreciate it?
That, you know, that's another thing. I think everybody we've had on the show, they have some type of ritual where they meditate or it's deep prayer or whatever it is. That is something that I think anybody out there, look at the clues. That is, you should make that part of your routine.
And practice healthy thinking. I think the best thing I do for my health is I correct myself when I go into bad think. You know, when you read as a person think, if you read a poem in the beginning and a part of that poem says, we think in secret and it comes to pass. Environment is but our looking glass. You know?
Yeah. I love that. Do you have any mantras? Do you have any
affirmations? My personal life mantra is never compromise who you are personally to become who you wish to be professionally. You know?
Love that.
We've seen examples. I mean, Elvis was so loved around the world, but Elvis didn't love himself when he died, you know? And I just think that it's really important for us to understand that. What was it? I was telling these young entrepreneurs at Morehouse Day Before Yesterday. I decided to change the language and make success a verb and not a noun. Let it be iterative. You know? I think these things are very important because we tend to measure success by the stuff we have instead of the stuff we feel. And so a lot of the people we measure, the Fortune 100 list, are people who are measured for success by the stuff they have. If you switch that and you measure it by the stuff they feel and the stuff they live, then the truly successful people are the people listening to you right now who got to get up and be at work at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know?
I love it.
But they come home and they got kids pulling on them and they're going to Little League and they're grilling on the weekend and, you know, they may be worried about how they're going to pay for the college education, But for God's sake, they love the little kids who they're raising who got to go to college, you know?
Yeah.
That's success. So I turn success into a noun and let it be iterative. Turn it into a verb and let it be iterative. Oh. I think it allows you to.
I love it.
Better.
I have a couple more questions. I wish that would be a great way to end it, but I do have a couple fun questions for you. Obviously, love food.
Love it.
What if you could make a food healthy that isn't healthy that you could eat all the time and say was the most, you can make this the most nutritious thing ever, what food would that be?
Well, see, I'm kind of going to have to give it to you because my favorite foods are sweet potatoes and peanuts. Everybody who knows me knows that.
Uh-huh.
And so you can do a lot with a sweet potato and you can do a lot with a peanut. Remember George Washington Carver? He even built the side of Henry Ford's cars with them. So, those are my favorite foods. Uh-huh. I don't have cheap foods that I would
really love to switch over. Pizza, deep dish, Chicago style pizza.
Oh, don't get me into trouble because I don't eat pizza. No, that's not my thing.
Nothing like that. A hamburger, a double burger. I love with Froyo. Bacon and, or something.
Froyo. I love Froyo. Froyo.
Okay, yeah. Froyo would be the one. That would be the one you'd make healthy.
Yeah, yeah, if you could pull the sugar out.
What is the best meal you can cook?
Oh, geez, ask the family. Here's the thing. Because I'm on the road so much, I pick up ideas about stuff, and then I go home, and then I do my own version of it. So my kids didn't grow up saying, oh, we just love mom's this or we love mom's that, because food was always different depending on where I've been. And that's a lot of countries. You know, I have top secret clearance. And the guy came back and said, wait a minute, you've just been to too many countries. They told me I had to come back and check you out. But I'm bringing all these thoughts and these ideas home, and I'm cooking them. And blessed to live in Southern California, I have access to so many different, you know, food things. So, but I think if you were going to ask my family before now, when I was growing up and we cooked as teenagers at home, they would say fried chicken and biscuits is what I do. Now, I cook from scratch, so I'm old school cooker.
Good.
And remember, I cook every day that I'm in town. I'll be cooking tonight.
All right. What are you cooking?
My husband told me he wanted liver, and because he could connect, I thought it was really good that he wanted that. I'm going to cook my husband some liver, and I'll cook him some fresh peas. And I'll cook him some potatoes the way his mom used to make them.
I'm giving a little face over here. Liver? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell
it's
you,
okay.
my sister says she didn't like lamb until she tasted mine. Uh-huh. I can do some stuff with some organs and some meat. Hold off on the liver until you taste mine, okay?
My mom used to cook it when I was a kid.
I hated it. I didn't like it either.
Yeah.
But I put a little twist on it, you know. One of my girlfriends said, you know, Janice, you really should just turn a lot of those dinners you do into a cookbook. I'm like, no, I ain't Martha Stewart.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I bet you should. Mm-hmm. If you could sit down with anybody in history, living or dead, who would you sit down with and what would be something you'd want to learn from them?
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
And I would want to sit with Jesus because, number one, I would want to truly answer the questions so many people ask around, you know, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the Trinity. I'd want to dig into that. Christians grow up and we are taught that it is a lack of faith to question God. And it's my understanding that a lot of Jews grow up and they are taught that it is your responsibility to question so that you can come into full understanding. While I don't suggest a rivalry in the approach, and I could totally be off, this is what I've been told, I do think that I like the idea of being able to question for information. In our company, we say we're in the information gathering business. And so I'd really love to sit down with Jesus.
Mm. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say that. That's a good one.
Yeah. I got my choice of women to sit down with?
Sure.
I would sit down with Madam C.J. Walker. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Nice.
I think she started something that given a little bit longer, could have been quite awesome, you know, or Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Mrs. Pinkers. Elizabeth Cady, Madam C.J. Walker, people say, oh, she's the first black woman to be a millionaire, have a million-dollar company, and she's the first woman, not black woman.
Yeah.
And up from slavery to do that. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Mrs. Pankhurst, these are people who march for freedom for women to vote, you know? Wow, would I love to talk with them. Mm-hmm. You know, we think we're brave because we do one thing. These are women who exercise bravery because they did the thing.
Uh-huh. You know? Uh-huh. Two more questions. Last one, it's like she just came at the top because you reminded me of something. If you could own a piece of history, something in history. When I answered this question, I said probably Jesse Owens' shoes from the Olympics.
Uh-huh. The stuff. I was thinking period, tangible. Era, like, you
any,
know,
any era,
like
whatever.
I was going to own the time in America during slavery and cut that part out.
No. I mean, like something tangible, something you can put up on your shelf or something like that.
Okay.
Throughout history, what would you want to put up on your mantle and have that there as a reminder for whatever?
Okay, I'm not a believer that the first thing that comes to mind is the thing. So give me a chance to come back later and change it if it changes, okay? But if I could have the thing, I want the paper that Dr. King, the paper for the notes from his I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm. That's a
great
one.
To see what he scratched in and out.
Uh-huh. Yeah, to see not what got in there, right? Because we all know that. What did he take out? That would be a good one.
Not going very back deep in history with that, but. Uh-huh.
That would be a good one. That's a good one. Good answer. Mm-hmm. Okay, last question. What's something that's happened lately in your life that you're wide open to learning more about?
Young people. Mm-hmm. Hanging with the really, really young people. And I hope my book does a little bit of this as well. So it kind of examples it in how I've written it. Hanging out with people on campuses. Some of the most fruitful period of thought for me was on the grounds of North Carolina A&T State University, Aggie Pride! And I find that I leave campuses so enthused, so excited. And so I'm really open to hanging out with young people today and learning from them, you know, and when somebody walks up to me and calls me auntie, I'm like, I'm owning it. I love it. You know, they throwing me praise, you know? And so I'm really enjoying that. Everything's happening on campuses, the teaching, the learning, the athletics, the band, mm-hmm. you know, I love that. I love that. It's the America that I pay taxes for, and it's the world that I really think is great. So, you know, wherever I am, whatever country I'm in, I try to visit a campus.
Miss Janice Bryan Howroyd, thank you so much for coming on my show. I appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless you. And thank you for everything you've done, everything you continue to do.
Appreciate it.
It's awesome.
Thank you. Go buy that book. Hey, what's up, guys? If you enjoyed the podcast, let me know about it at TonyGonzalez88 on all social media platforms. I would love to hear from you. Feedback, what you liked, what you didn't like. I'm a big boy. I can take it because I want to make sure that I'm helping. You know, I want to help all you guys, gals, level up, be the best version of yourselves. We're all in this together. And the only way I can help you is by you helping me and letting me know in the comment section. Like I said, it's on all social media outlets at TonyGonzalez88.